October 16th, 1977. It had been 4 days since Lufthansa plane 181 was hijacked. After German forces had chased it to 6 different countries, the plane had finally set down for a week in Dubai. British SAS operatives and German GSG-9 specialists thought they finally had an opening to storm the plane.
The defense minister, who was actually running the whole show in Dubai, came down and we did a demonstration for him. The demonstration was really slick. He liked it, and he gave us the green light to go that night.
The teams had spent days rehearsing the rescue on a model plane. They would split into small groups and take the plane from all sides, using the element of surprise. But before they could, a surprise got them.
We saw the plane taken off, and then we were told that the plane had just left on its own accord. I mean, there was a lot of disappointment. But Alistair and I thought we were going to return to UK.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations.
If the hand grenades go off, they could cause a sympathetic explosion. The whole aircraft could be wrecked.
I'm Jamie Rennell. I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
Basically, the feeling was there that we'd negotiated, we'd chased them. You just had a feeling if we didn't do something, the deadline was 12 o'clock. If we didn't do something by 12 o'clock, then they would kill somebody or kill them all.
The plane and their plans back up in the air, the SAS and GSG-9 had to act quickly before the hijackers got restless and someone innocent would die.
In any counterinsurgency operation, if someone is killed, the operation goes into a much higher gear. Now GSG-9 knew that deaths, more deaths, might be impending. They had to act quickly to save lives.
This is Feuerzauber, Lufthansa Hijack, Part 2. Flight LH-181, also known as the Landshut, was on the move. On board, the terrorist leader, calling himself Mahmoud, forced the pilot, Captain Schumann, to set a course south. The hijacked plane headed south toward Aden in Yemen, then known as South Yemen. But during the 3-hour flight, the terrorists revealed a terrifying fact. They hadn't just brought guns on the plane. Author of Storming Flight 181, Chris McNabb, says they had quite the arsenal.
The terrorists took on board with them 2 handguns, 6 hand grenades, and about 2 kilos of plastic explosive. And later in the hijack, they distributed the plastic explosive around the interior of the aircraft. One press of a button, the whole aircraft could be destroyed.
The rescue mission had become far riskier. One hint of a rescue operation, and the whole plane could go up, killing everyone on board instantly. Hey folks, I want to talk a little bit about some bad decisions that I made as a kid. So I got into some credit card debt really early, right in college, doing some of the things that every college kid does. Did you know the average interest rate on credit card debt is over 19% APR? Have you looked at your interest rate lately? Right now, Lightstream is offering you a way to consolidate your debt into a low fixed rate. You can save thousands in interest. So pay off your high-interest credit cards with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. You can get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with autopay, and that is so much lower than the national average interest rate on credit card debt. So right now, I've got a special offer just for my listeners. Apply today at lightstream.com/covert and get an additional interest rate discount. That's lightstream.com/covert for an additional discount. LIGHTSTREAM.com/covert. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50 auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/covert for more information. As the plane approached Aden, Captain Schumann requested landing permission. But just as with Damascus and Baghdad, this request was denied.
the runway is filled with military vehicles, and the radio commands say you cannot land here. Schumann, however, knows he has no choice. The fuel is exceptionally low. He makes a low pass to check out the situation, then comes back in again and lands on some rough auxiliary runways just next to the main runway. But this is a terrifying moment for the passengers. This is a rough landing. They are braced for disaster.
They didn't have enough fuel to go anywhere else. So Captain Schumann made a choice. Without permission, he decided to land on a rough strip of runway anyway. The surface was soft and sand-like, not the hard asphalt the plane is made for. The plane began to touch down, wheels hitting spinning rocks and skidding wildly. Luckily, the wheels didn't lock, and Schumann was able to make a safe landing. But the relief of the landing was only temporary. South Yemen was not about to let some strange plane stay in their airport. The authorities wanted Landshut to get straight back into the air. The landing was rough. It was possible that the plane wasn't airworthy after that. Schumann likely wanted to go outside and inspect it.
Incredibly, Mahmoud consents to this. He understands that the undercarriage needs to be in sound condition.
Mahmoud had no choice but to let him check. The plane was his only way out of South Yemen, too. Schumann jumped down onto the desert floor and began to look under the plane for any signs of damage. It all seemed to be going well. The plane was fine, at least. But Schumann started walking away from the plane towards the airport authorities.
Schumann gets off the aircraft and starts inspecting the undercarriage, but then realizes he needs the help of the Aden authorities. Crucially, without Mahmoud's permission, he walks across the runway and goes to the Aden control tower.
From inside the plane, the hostage passengers could see the pilot talking with the officials before then returning to the plane. Once again, everything looks fine, but it isn't.
When Schumann gets back on board the aircraft, he's faced with an enraged Mahmoud. He's defied his orders. In a terrifying moment for the passengers and in an awful end for Captain Schumann, he's slapped about the face by Mahmoud and then shot once in the head.
Mahmoud shot Schumann in the face. The pilot's body was dragged back onto the plane, put in full view of everyone on board.
The impact of Captain Schumann's death was appalling on the passengers. Now they knew beyond a doubt that the terrorists would carry through their threats to kill people. They also had the terrifying presence of Captain Schumann's body at the back of the aircraft as a horrible reminder of what might happen to them.
In an instant, the stakes had changed. There was now blood on their hands and little hope of a negotiated settlement. Ex-Navy SEAL Stu Smith explains.
So it showed everybody on the team that these guys are meaning business. They just change the dynamics of the game when you kill an innocent person. And now the mission is going to happen. You know, it's going to happen. There's no doubt in any of the team members' minds it's going to happen. We just have to find out when. And now when you start killing people, it probably needs to go sooner than later.
The feat of flying now fell to co-pilot Jürgen Viator. After 10 hours on the ground, Viator coaxed the plane back into the air. Mahmoud now set the course for Mogadishu, Somalia. Back in Dubai, the GSG-9 and the SAS were figuring out their next steps. They had missed the key opportunity to get the hostages back, and South Yemen was refusing entry to the GSG-9, same as they did with the hijacked plane. SAS officer Barry Davies explains that they didn't know if there was even a mission to continue.
I mean, there was a lot of disappointment. As I said, Alistair and I thought we were going to return to UK. The Germans asked us to stay. We got there. We were discussing what we're going to do next. Wisniewski, I believe, made the decision that we'd follow them. And we actually flew to Saudi Arabia. And he came down and talked to us. He said, gentlemen, I'm sorry, we changed the decision again. Yeah, it's going to be a military option.
In the early morning, the Somali airport authorities had gotten in touch with the German embassy. The missing plane had, in fact, landed in Somalia. And what they said was disturbing.
Wisniewski came on, and he was not looking very pleased. And he just said, they've killed Jürgen Schumann. And he actually said, from now on, we follow them to the ends of the earth. And he pushed the negotiator out of the way, because the negotiator went to say something. And he said, push them out of the way. You know, I don't need you anymore, basically. After that, we took off and we flew to Mogadishu.
As the Landshut touched down at the Mogadishu airport, a Somali ambulance approached the plane. Captain Schumann's body was unceremoniously dumped on the tarmac, where it was retrieved. The co-pilot, Viator, was told this would be the last stop, and for getting them safely aground, Mahmoud offered to let him leave. Viator opted to stay. Mahmoud, meanwhile, began his negotiations with the Somali police and German embassy staff.
You have to realize that by this stage of the hijack, Mahmoud's mental state has completely deteriorated. He's near insane from a lack of sleep. The pressure of the hijack is starting to get to him. He's becoming increasingly unstable as the minutes go by.
Mahmoud had the same demands as before: release the Red Army faction prisoners from Germany and hand over $15 million. But he set up a new ultimatum. If his comrades were not delivered by 3 o'clock that afternoon, the plane and everyone in it will be blown up.
Intelligence understood Captain Mahmoud would do anything to get his goals accomplished. And that would be to kill innocent civilians, blow up planes, and destroy property. It didn't matter.
The GSG-9 was waiting anxiously to get into action. But first, the German politicians had to negotiate with the local government as well as with the terrorists. Writer Chris McNabb explains that Hans-Jürgen Wischnewski, the special envoy, had to be careful when negotiating with Mahmoud.
Wischnewski's negotiations with Mahmoud became increasingly fraught as the hijacking went on. Mahmoud's mental state steadily worsened, and he became more and more dangerous. So Wischnewski had to constantly try and calm him down while playing for time and not raising suspicion at the same time.
Basically, the feeling was there that we'd negotiated, we'd chased them. You just had a feeling if we didn't do something, then they would kill somebody or kill them all, themselves included.
The negotiations were going nowhere, and so Mahmoud decided to make himself a serious threat. With half an hour to go before his deadline expired, he prepared to incinerate the aircraft and its occupants.
And they tied everybody up, the women with their tights, the men with their ties, and they poured alcohol over them so they burned quickly.
There's a terrifying moment during the flight from Aegean to Mogadishu where Mahmoud takes all the flammable spirits on board and tips them over the heads of the passengers, basically making them firebombs. And he explains to them that they're all going to burn if the situation turns bad.
As the situation worsened, a message came through to air traffic control.
Gabby Dillman, a young stewardess, is put on the radio to the German negotiation team. She makes a heartfelt plea for their lives, but also there's a very bleak note to it. She mentions at one point, "We know that this is the end and we shall all die."
The people inside the aircraft got the feeling that they were getting close to the end. We thought, if we don't do it now, you just had the feeling it was going to go.
Wischnewski realized he was out of time and adopted a high-risk strategy. He told Mahmoud the RAF prisoners were being released and were on their way. It was, of course, a bold-faced lie.
They were being talked to as we were surrounding the aircraft and told that they'd won and told them they could have the money. And told them they could actually talk to their friends who had been released from jails in Germany and would be on an aircraft and they could talk to them very soon. All these things gave them some hope that they were going to win.
The time it would take for the RAF prisoners to travel would give the GSG-9 the extra time they needed to strike. They now had until 2:30 a.m. to rescue the hostages. With the pressure mounting, Wischnewski finally asked the Somali government to let the rescue raid go ahead.
And we were told to wait and until we were cleared to come off the aircraft. Wischnewski had the Prime Minister there and promised them all sorts of aid, weapons, everything else to help them fight the war. And that did the trick.
They agreed. And the GSG-9 flew into the airport to start figuring out a new operation.
At that stage, when Wisniewski said it was going to be a military option, there was a total mood change with everybody. The fact that the pilot had been murdered, they'd knelt him down in a plane and blew his brains out, really affected everybody. And we were then gearing up. We were gearing up to go for it. We knew there was going to be an operation then, and we took off.
Like in Dubai, the Somali government insisted that local soldiers were involved in the operation as well. But this time, the full GSG-9 contingent of 60 highly trained operatives were allowed into Somalia.
When we came to land, they turned the plane around immediately and drove back down to what we called the holding area later on, down by sheds, away from the hijacked plane. We sat on the aircraft until the Somalis came.
Commander Ulrich Wegener wasted no time and worked on the revised plan.
Basically, the plan in Mogadishu was an elaborate, a more elaborate plan than we'd had in Dubai. In Mogadishu, we had full team there, and we opened all doors simultaneously and the wings, so we had multiple entry points.
The plan was to approach the aircraft from its blind spot, the rear. They would position assault ladders against the aircraft's fuselage at six entrance points. And the Somali troops would set off an explosion 300 meters away as a distraction. At the same time, stun grenades would disorient the enemy long enough to allow Wegener's men in. Once through the doors, the team would systematically move through the Landshut until it was cleared of the terrorists. But former SAS fighter pilot Nigel Ellie explained that this mission was still risky.
The aircraft, attack aircraft, has become real bad. It's a real bad situation because every terrorist on the planet now knows what the scenario is. There's only one way to attack an aircraft, okay? And there's for minimum damage. I mean, this is why airport security has got to be 100%. To stop these sons of bitches getting on there, because it is a bad, bad target to attack.
All right, listeners, I want to talk a little bit about Duke Cannon. Is it possible that a bar of soap could be patriotic? I mean, that's kind of crazy, right? It's just a bar of soap. It doesn't get out a little flag and go to parades and all that kind of stuff. But consider this. Duke Cannon's superior quality grooming goods for hardworking men were tested by soldiers. Duke Cannon partners with active duty military to develop new ideas and review products, and anything that doesn't meet their high standards, it doesn't happen. Plus, Duke Cannon is committed to giving back to the men and women serving our country. That's why a portion of their proceeds go directly towards veteran causes, and that's pretty awesome. Duke Cannon sells a bunch of stuff that you absolutely have to have and nothing that you don't. I personally like the News Anchor Pomade. It's a great blend of a medium hold. It doesn't give my hair shine and it really smells great. It's kind of a sandalwood scent. I'm also a big fan of my Best Damn Beard Wash because I have a beard and quite frankly, I don't want to look like a hermit. So for my listeners, I want to give you a big discount, okay? Visit DukeCannon.com right now and get 15% off your first order with the promo code COVERT. Now, you got to use COVERT as your promo code, okay? Free shipping on orders over $35. Go do it right now. AM, an hour before Mahmoud's deadline expired. Wegener's assault team formed up at the end of the runway.
If I'm really honest, you don't think about the hostages. The hostages are not on the list of priorities. They are the most important part as far as saving them is concerned. But you don't think about them. You think about gaining access, because without gaining access, you can't do anything. You think about getting to the aircraft, because if you can't get up on scene, you're going to give the game away. And once you're inside, you think about closing with the terrorist and annulling the terrorist. We don't think about the hostages at all.
Separately, GSG-9 snipers had moved into concealed positions around the Landshut. They analyzed the movements of the terrorists through the small windows. Carefully, they reported on the exact movements of each terrorist. The team had to cross hundreds of meters of runway without being seen or heard.
snipers were in position. They told us that the blinds were down and the coast was clear. So we all formed up in the dedicated order, and in one big line we walked towards the rear of the aircraft because there's a blind spot on the aircraft. Unfortunately, as we were walking towards the aircraft, the big searchlights, which light up the old airfield, okay, throwing shadows at least 30 meters long. And if you'd looked out the window, you'd have seen this line of shadows coming towards you. Couldn't miss it. I mean, it was quite something. Luckily, the windows were closed.
As the assault team approached, the Somali government was keeping the terrorists occupied. They checked in periodically about where the released prisoners were on the journey and repeated the platitude that they had won.
Please don't kill anybody because you've won, you've won. And apparently in the plane, so Suhaila told me many years later, they were all elated. They actually thought that they had won. By this time, we'd reached underneath of the aircraft. Everybody got in their position. They put the ladder up against the rear door.
The team gathered under the fuselage in their designated squads, ready.
We all got into our positions underneath the aircraft, and then the teams with the ladders put them against the wing and also against the doors, front and rear. The problem was they'd used the ladders on the 707, which is a much larger aircraft than the 737. And when I was at the rear on the starboard side, and when they put the ladder against it, it didn't fit. It was too long. And so they'd bring the medics in from the further back, bring them up and put them on the shoulder. And they were literally holding the ladder up while the two guys climbed up on it. The same thing was going on everywhere. I then got my two grenades. I pulled a pin out of both of them. I was holding the grenades. Ulrich Wegener was literally down right below me. And I can remember smiling. He counted down from 10.
4. Wegener continued 3, his countdown. 2. As he said 1, a huge explosion violently broke out close by. On cue, the Somali military had set up an enormous fire only 100 feet from the nose of the plane. Barry Davies explained that it was much more intense than he had been expecting.
The Somalis were to ignite their fire. Well, there was an almighty bang, and I think a whole bowser worth of petrol went up. It just lit the place up like daylight. And it was one of the things that I think everybody was laughing, I think more than I was. And it was a good diversion.
The diversion was good, but would only distract the terrorists for so long. It was now or never.
Even on training, the adrenaline just jumps up right to 100%, and you go. I threw the first stun grenade over the cockpit, and I threw the second one right across the cabin. And there was a mighty flash and bang. Doors were open. The next thing, as I turned and looked, doors were already open. The first guy on the left, the SG9 guy, had opened the door and used his body weight to swing it open. He had opened the left foot, and the second guy was in. And as I looked up, there was a woman standing there, and she had a black T-shirt on with a red Che Guevara silhouette on it. And the guy just put a burst straight into her and she fell into the toilet. He then dived inside the aircraft.
The plane was still rigged with explosives. They had to move quickly.
When the GS9 went in, they were shouting, "Hinlegen, Hinlegen, get your head down, basically. Stay down, stay down."
As the passengers in the plane hit the ground, one figure advanced. In his hands were two grenades.
If the hand grenades go off, they could cause a sympathetic explosion. The whole aircraft could be wrecked. But GSG-9 officers have only one choice. They shoot him immediately, and he drops dead.
That was two down. But then something terrible happened. A soldier's worst nightmare. The two grenades fell out of the dead man's limp hands, and the pins dislodged. Smoke and flames ripped across the cabin. Shrapnel from the grenades hit stewardess Gabi Dilman and another passenger. But the GSG-9 and everyone else have had a lucky escape. The grenade, it seems, was poorly made.
It went off. I think most of it absorbed by the seating. Grenades, concussion, it wasn't a very good grenade. I mean, I think they were quite weak. It's a round one. It's basically a Russian round grenade. I can't remember the designation of it, but it went off onto the seat. There was two. They got the other one. And I think the splinter from that went to Gabby Dillman's leg, one of the stewardesses, and that was the only injury for the whole thing.
GSG-9 jumped back into action. As one team moved forward, another tried to get the passengers off the plane as quickly as possible.
I was on the starboard wing, Starboard wing door was open, both of them were open, and they were getting the passengers off. They had to get most of the people out untied. They were tied up. Get most of the people out, and they started coming out in their droves.
At the front of the aircraft, another GSG-9 section slowly advanced towards the cockpit. They needed to corner the most dangerous terrorist in the group, Captain Mahmoud. Suddenly, the cockpit door opened. In reckless abandon, Mahmoud fired a torrent of bullets toward the squad. One fighter was hit, but kept fighting.
The officer's returned fire, though, and is hit by five .38 bullets. He staggers back into the cockpit. He's still dangerous, reaching for a hand grenade. The door swings to, but an officer puts a burst of MP5 submachine gun fire straight through the door. It hits Mahmoud full on, and the leader is killed.
Three of the terrorists were now out of action, but there's still one who was missing.
For the GSG-9 team, there's a dangerous moment towards the end of the raid. Three of the terrorists have been taken out. Most of the passengers have been evacuated or in the process of being evacuated, but it steadily becomes apparent that one of the hijackers is missing. This situation is still not fully under control. There are still explosives on the aircraft, there are still weapons, there's still a dangerous individual. The GSG-9 team have to find her and find her quickly.
Mahmoud was obviously dead, and they put all the bodies outside, but then they moved everybody to the 737 negotiating plane, and we moved our kit from the negotiating plane into the GSG-9 707 that they'd arrived on. And so the whole team, Wisniewski and everybody, moved on to the GSG-9 aircraft that had come in that evening, while all the passengers were put on the negotiating plane. They put them on there, and we were basically about to take off, and it was Alistair Morrison, in fairness, who said, "What about sleepers?" And they hadn't thought about it. And immediately they rushed the team. They stopped everything. They rushed the team from our plane across to the passenger plane and put a team on there just in case there were sleepers on board.
The missing terrorist was a woman, Suhaila Saya. But where was she? Could she be hiding in amongst the passengers? GSG-9 swept through the cabin, pushing anyone in their way onto the wing of the plane. And they heard a strange sound coming from the lavatory. They closed in and opened the door. Multiple bullets struck Suhaila, and the fourth terrorist was accounted for. By 2:14 a.m., 16 minutes to spare, the mission was over. Wegener radioed in the code word Springtime. Operation Fire Magic was a success. Two of the hostages were wounded, but they were alive.
Terrorists are no match for regular troops, especially special forces that are well-trained. They're never going to win on that. I mean, the reason terrorists win is because they do things unexpectedly. They plant a bomb. It goes off when they're not there, or they're controlling by a radio. They're not anywhere near it. Terrorists win because they do unexpected things. Once they see you coming towards them, once you're within 2 or 3 meters of them, I mean, the last thing goes through their head is, I want to stay alive. They will try and stop you. They'll try and shoot you. They'll try and kill you. And you're wearing the best body armor money can buy. And, you know, and you're a better shot than them. And you've got a better weapon than them.
Wisniewski and Wegener breathed a sigh of relief. The one surviving terrorist, Suhaila Saya, was stretchered off the plane, defiant to the end.
Once it was all over, the people inside were controlled. They brought the bodies off the aircraft and they put them on the deck. The moment they got Suhaila out, which they thought was dead, she was very much alive, and they put her on a stretcher, and she put her hands up in the air and two fingers and shouted, Free Palestine.
Later that morning, the team flew back to Germany. They had brought 86 hostages home with minimal injuries and damage. They were ready for a celebration.
Both aircraft took off side by side, and we flew to Germany. And at that stage, everybody was really elated. And I didn't realize Lufthansa carried so much alcohol. And we opened the alcohol and we started drinking, and we were all patting ourselves on the back and saying how good we were. And we were really pleased. And how the newspaper published the fact on the same day, I still don't know. But I'm sure somebody does. We then flew back. As I say, we were celebrating ourselves. Wisniewski was really, really pleased with the operation, the way it gone, and he was really grateful for our help and everything else. And we made really good friends with the GSG-9 on that on that time coming back. Both aircraft then landed temporarily at Bonn, I believe it was, and then we flew on to St. Augustine again, and where there was a massive welcoming committee to the GSG9. I mean, massive. We had armed guards in uniform with machine guns all along the top of the flat building. We came running out the plane, lined up in three ranks, and the minister came and said some words, and everything else was great, and came down personally to shake our hands, everybody, and he said something in, I can forget, but he said in German to me, and then I said, you're more than welcome, English, and he hugged me. But on his shoulder, there was a guy in a Mac, a long trench coat, and he said, come with me. So me and Alistair went with him, went to the VIP lounge, escorted up there, and still looking filthy, dirty, having been washed and shaved for about a week. And all the VIP people were watching on television. All they do is stand up and look at the window, you can see it. And they're watching on television, and the general manager of Lufthansa and British Airways came in and said, is there anything you need? When we were in Dubai, when we first arrived in Dubai, they'd taken our passports, and then a Reuters reporter, it was, actually got it, and he pushed them worldwide, and everybody realised straight away we were SAS. And they didn't try to hide it after that. They were quite pleased.
Wegener and his team landed in Germany to a hero's welcome. Germany had been facing a lot of terror attacks in the last few years. This was a real victory.
The mission in Mogadishu was successful because it sent a message out to the terrorist world that they no longer held all the cards. Indeed, terrorist hijackings of aircraft started to decline significantly over the next few years. Tactically, it had been a brilliant success. The hostages had been saved, the terrorists had been taken out, and there'd been little loss of life apart from the incredibly brave captain, Captain Schumann.
The mission had avoided civilian death, but it wasn't bloodless. Captain Schumann had been killed trying to keep everyone else safe. Three of the four hijackers were killed on the plane, and when the news of the mission reached the RAF prisoners in Germany, they committed suicide.
And then Wisniewski came down and said, Bader Meinhof in Stanheim jail have just committed suicide. Nobody give a monkeys. At that stage, we weren't really interested in them. It didn't register that, you know, they commit suicide. How the hell they knew that the operation had been a success so quickly? We were just still in the air. I don't know.
But the operation had a more constructive effect as well. In the following years, Special Forces teams around the world studied Operation Fire Magic as the textbook hostage rescue from a hijacked plane.
As a young Navy SEAL officer, you know, we studied successful missions. And this mission was one that we studied, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. The GSG-9 mission was a perfect mission of everything kind of working together at one time, meaning the political side, the intelligence gathering side, negotiators, and the 5-minute special operations drill that was stretched out into a 4-day ordeal went pretty much flawless. Because once the special operators got there, they created the diversion, they created confusion with the stun grenades. They were able to get in and out of there with all passengers alive within 5 minutes. Completely successful mission.
The operation in Mogadishu put GSG-9 on the map and gave them a deserved reputation for tactical excellence and for efficiency. And they've built on that reputation ever since.
In the next episode, four women in Afghanistan were providing medical aid and crisis help when they were unexpectedly taken hostage. It was unclear who was the enemy and what they wanted. So it would take both British and American forces, and they would have to operate delicately.
Military operation nowadays is defined by what's called the three Fs. Find, that's location. Fixing, making sure that the people in that location are there when you get there. And finish, which is the conduct of the operation itself. And often meaning, of course, kill.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audioboom and World Media Rights co-production. hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audioboom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audioboom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.